The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Hi, everybody. It's so nice to see you. And still strange in the little boxes here in this weird COVID summer. But very nice to be here sitting with you, and thank you so much for joining us. For those of you that I haven't met, my name is Fusho, my Dharma name is Fusho. I'm a senior student at the Village Zendo, and I'm here on the Lower East Side, still mostly staying at home, like many of you. I know things are pretty tumultuous and still pretty uncertain and can feel really pretty crazy. So just want to say I hope you're doing okay and send some love out there. I've really been enjoying sitting online with our community in the mornings. It's been a crazy time, and it's been a really good time to be supported by other people who are sitting and doing the same things. And for me, you know, even this opportunity to sit a little bit extra has been nice in the morning. It's extra for me in the mornings because I usually sit one period, but now I'm sitting two periods, which has been great. You know, it's kind of a funny thing to be sitting alone but together, looking away from each other, but still supporting each other in that way, which is so nice. And we certainly have a lot to be sitting with these days. So I've actually been thinking a little bit about some of the basics and why we're sitting and what the sitting can do and how it can help us and why we're doing it, which I think is always a good thing to examine. Most of you know, but if you don't, in Zen, you know, we have some of our study is based on something called koans. And there are these cases and historical documents that were written a long time ago that represent conversations between students and teachers and point to ways to encourage us to continue practicing. So that's what we use a lot when we're talking, giving a Dharma talk. And the one that I've been thinking about is a case or a koan in the Book of Serenity called Luzu Faces the Wall. So it goes like this. Whenever Luzu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. And Nanquan, hearing of this, said, "I usually tell them to realize mastery before the empty aeon, to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Still, I haven't found one or a half. Luzu that way will go on till the year of the ass." So basically, there was a teacher who was offering instruction and was there to help students learn about realizing the way. But every time they came to ask him for advice or for a teaching or a question, he would just turn and face the wall. And, you know, in Zen, when we meditate, we face the wall, which can seem kind of cold in certain ways. But it's really a way of tuning out distractions and tuning in and really working to let go of our ideas and our thoughts and our maybe misguided way of seeing things, or just to look at the way that we really see things in order to respond to our lives in a different way. But he didn't offer anything. He would just turn and face the wall. So Nanquan, who I like to say came up with him, who was also a teacher, but they were students together, says, when my students come to me, I usually tell them that this practice is about realizing who you were, who we are, before time started, before the empty eon, to understand even before the idea of Buddhas or awakening or enlightenment, of gaining or not having, gaining or loss, even before that existed, try to understand what that is. And so that's the practice. That's what we do. But I also think that Nanquan was pointing out that if you just are doing that, which he had never found anybody who could, first of all, who would completely do that, you would be trapped doing that forever. And that Luzu might go on that way until the year of the ass. And the year of the ass in the Chinese calendar doesn't exist. So perhaps he could be going on in that sort of state of what we say sometimes is emptiness or enlightenment. This idea where absolutely no thought exists. You know, I think he's saying you can get stuck there. It's a very important part of the practice, but it's not everything. It's not all of the practice. Sometimes there's this idea about sitting and letting go of our thoughts and letting go of all of our emotions and any association or attachment to anything, that we just kind of push it all away and we just deny it and disengage. But these teachers quite often remind us that that's actually not what we're doing. And also, if we are doing that, how does that help us really? Or help us serve others. The idea in the koan about saying turning and facing the wall, you know, it goes back to sort of the very beginning with Bodhidharma coming to study and looking for enlightenment and sitting and facing the wall for 9 years. So that koan, there's a koan called Emperor Wu Asked Bodhidharma. And Emperor Wu came and asked Great Master Bodhidharma, what's the ultimate meaning of the holy truth? And Bodhidharma said, vast and void, no holiness, so nothing. And the emperor said, well, who are you facing me if there's nothing in this universe? And Bodhidharma said, I don't know. And the emperor didn't understand. And the saying goes that then Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and he came to Shaolin Temple, and that's where he sat, facing the wall. So that's what we call wall gazing, this intense, serious form of meditation. But the question is always, how can the traces be swept away or the footprints be eliminated so that we can be awakened? There's a companion book to this book of this book. I think that people who might be taking the path class are studying the Book of Equanimity. And that's by Jerry Jishin Wick. And he has his own commentary on this koan about facing the wall. He says it can be so hard to face what's really in front of us, what's on the wall. And he mentions that his teacher, Maizumi Roshi, who was also Enkyo Roshi's teacher, used to say, it's easy to sit facing the wall, but it's not easy to sit facing the wall. You know, and I was mentioning when I started, there's so much, you know, we have that saying, writing on the wall. There's a lot of that that comes up. But boy, is there a lot of writing on the wall right now, today, in this world. We have a lot of emotions and unrest and fear and obviously sickness, loss of livelihood, and a lot of unknowing about what the future holds. And that is all included in what comes up when we're facing the wall. So our practice is helping us cultivate this awareness in a way that allows us to respond to all of that without denying it, pushing it away, or grasping too tightly to it. And once we've been facing the wall enough and things have dropped away, hopefully, or started to, or even just a little bit shifted, which they do naturally, it enables us to get up being changed off of the cushion and perhaps respond to all of this and to this not knowing in a different way, in a way that naturally includes compassion. So we're going to be studying Dogen's painting of a rice cake in our upcoming retreat, our online first online summer retreat. But Dogen's always great to come back to for just the basics, because he's known as the founder of Soto Zen. And he has advice on practicing. And in his guidelines for studying the way, he advises, just forget yourself for now and practice inwardly. You should know that arousing practice in the midst of delusion, you attain realization before you recognize it. And he reminds us that what practice calls forth is enlightenment, and that how enlightenment functions is through practice. So the functioning of our awakening is happening as we're facing the wall, and then as we're getting up and interacting with the world. And the question is that any different than facing the wall? Because when we're facing all of this constant change or unrest or upheaval, we begin to realize that constant change and flux is actually reality, the nature of reality. And that everything is constantly changing and in flux, even though we might not feel it. So if we can begin to get a little bit comfortable with that, then that in turn allows us to become a little more free and to change ourselves. But we do need to face it before we can change it. There's a verse after the koan. It's a poem about it that also points to what happens after we face the wall, I think. In plainness, there's flavor, subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign. Unbending like an idiot, her path is lofty, just facing the wall. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn, pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters afar. So there's a comment about plainness and flavor. And it goes, there is a flavor in plainness. It's like the nature of water. When you add tea or honey, bitterness or sweetness are produced therein. Nature is also still and calm. If you make waves with delusion and enlightenment, then ordinary and holy are established therein. So out of this plainness or this jade, pure jade, or this pure pearl, if you carve a pattern in it, it loses its purity. But I think, you know, that loss of purity is actually our life, and that we are the jade with the pattern carved on it. So as we sit and face the wall, and the question is, what is the wall each one of us is facing? We can look at what's happening directly in front of us. And sometimes that can be very painful. If we can directly face the pain, that's the pain in our life. And if we can't, then we're sort of missing it. What's on the right wall right now is obviously COVID and divisive politics and a scary time, lots of livelihoods being lost, and whatever other 10,000 things are arising in our life. It can be really overwhelming. So I've been turning to Rebecca Solnit, who some of you probably know, is a wonderful writer and historian and activist, who wrote Hope in the Dark after 9/11. And she spent a lot of time studying the way people, humans throughout history, respond to disaster. And she's recently written a lot about everything we're going through right now. And she wrote a recent essay called The Way We Get Through This Is Together. She says, one of the biggest cliches about disasters is that they reveal civilization as a thin veneer beneath which lies brutal human nature. From this perspective, the best we can hope for most people under crisis is selfish indifference, or worse, at worst, violence. Our worst instincts must be repressed. And this becomes a justification for authoritarianism and heavy-handed policing, which might sound a little bit familiar. But she says that studies of historical disasters have shown that this is not how most people actually behave. There's almost always selfish and destructive people, and they're often in power, because we have created systems that reward that kind of personality and those principles. But the great majority of people in ordinary disasters behave in ways that are anything but selfish. And actually, what gets peeled off is a lot of creative and generous altruism and brilliant grassroots organizing. And with this global pandemic, these empathic urges and actions are wider and deeper and more consequential than ever, because this is something we're going through globally. And her thought about this particular moment with COVID-19 is that there is an inherent radicalizing, because life has become uncertain and dangerous, and people feel what matters has shifted, and what you need to fight for and what you think you can win has shifted. So I can sometimes see a similarity in our experience on the cushion when things come up that feel very frightening or completely unknown, or when we think what we see what we thought we knew is no longer true, or who we are might not be real or true according to the ideas that we had. It can be a bit scary. This whole not knowing, you know, thing can feel tumultuous. But she says there's something in human nature. You might even call it the bodhisattva nature, that can be brought out, and that does come out naturally And we try to help each other generally. And we recognize ourselves in the other. There's another fairly hopeful op-ed for a change by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. He reached out, he says, through the gloom of these days to consult people. And he said, you know, historians and people who are activists. And he said that he was struck by how much hope he's been hearing. So he says, we might be so desperate, our failures to manifest our grief are so raw that the United States can once more, as during the Great Depression, embrace long needed changes that would have been impossible in cheerier times. This idea of hope in the dark comes from not knowing. And we just need to remember that many times surprising things arise out of not knowing. Not always good, not always bad. He says history does not unfold smoothly. Policies do not evolve gradually, much like our practice. Rather, they develop like animal species throughout what evolutionary biologists call punctuated equilibrium. Long periods of stasis and short bouts of intense variation. And often this change is driven by traumas, like in the American Revolution or the Great Depression. So Solnit, in her essay, talking about how humans actually naturally do try to help each other, has been recognizing the fact that these days, recently, a lot of mutual aid has been arising all over the world. Collectives, organizations, groups, nonprofits, neighbors, just people, getting together to try to take care of each other. And she talks about the ideals of mutual aid, which are defined as solidarity, not charity. And she sees that surfacing a lot. Charity often implies that the afflicted population is powerless or incompetent to address its own needs. And solidarity is, first of all, an affirmation that we're in this together. And mutual aid demonstrates that even in crisis, we have strength and capacity to care for ourselves. There is historical evidence that argues that aiding and protecting others and serving the needs of the group rather than the individual has actually been essential to the survival of many species and is evident in early and traditional human societies. She says, you know, even after these big dramatic catastrophes happen, people who think they want things to go back to normal often find that they're changed permanently in their sense of who they are and what matters most. And that this pandemic could mark the end of an era and the beginning of another, one whose harshness must be mitigated by a spirit of generosity. She says the basic generosity and empathy of most ordinary people should be regarded as a treasure, a light and an energy source that can drive a better society. And I believe that our practice of facing the wall on our own, even if it's in a digital realm together and together, helps us shine a light on that treasure so that we can respond to what's in front of us and be responsible for it and then begin to change it.